Beverly McKeever grew up in a world of racial injustice and violence. As a young girl, she got into clowning, dressing in whiteface and wearing a wig. When she got older and became an artist, she did a series of self-portraits showing herself once again in whiteface. But that's changing.
Just being, you know, who I am, and taking off the wigs and showing my dreadlocks and showing my skin, my face, and who I really am. So I think it's, you know, it's been over time where, you know, I'm comfortable in my skin and I don't want to be white and I don't want to be blackface, that it's just great to just be me.
Beverly's path has now taken her even closer to who she is. After over a decade away, she's now moved back home. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
When Beverly McKeever was a kid, she didn't play much outside. Her mother had a two-bedroom apartment in the Morningside Homes housing project in Greensboro, North Carolina, and she told the girls that it wasn't safe to be out. Beverly remembers that they didn't play on the grass that was there because it was strung with clotheslines. She also remembers drugs and guns and killing.
Actually, I was in high school when the KKK came through and shot and killed 5 Communist Party workers right in front of our apartment building.
Were you home when that happened?
Actually, I was working at McDonald's, and I was not home. But my mother was home, and so was Renee and my cousin. And, you know, my mother witnessed the entire event and was subpoenaed to testify. We had a Pinto, a green Pinto, which you actually can see in some of the news footage when they show the footage of the shootings and stuff. And the car was actually shot. A bullet penetrated the back end of the car on the driver's side, very close to the gas tank. But it exploded, the bullet did. And so there was no physical bullet that we could, you know, save.
You looked for it, though.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I would have, too. Now, that was, they talked about that as the Greensboro Massacre, right? The killing of those 5
yes.
Communist Party workers?
It was a rally that was planned and, you know, the police knew about it, et cetera. And the fact that it was, you know, that it was switched to the location where there, you know, there were kids out there playing and people were going about their daily lives. And then all of a sudden, the KKK just pulled up in a white van and started shooting.
Were these black people who were shot?
Yep, I think some of them were white, but some of them were black. I remember that one woman was shot who was pregnant, and I think both of them lost their lives in that exchange.
Tell me about coming home after your shift at McDonald's on that day, what you were thinking, what you were seeing.
Well, my mother was terrified, you know, because I wasn't driving. I didn't have a car to drive. And she didn't want to drive, and she was like, you know, catch a cab. And I was like, what's going on? Because I was clean across town on Battleground, which was close to Grimsley High School, where I was a student at the time. And I just remember, you know, the manager coming up to me and saying, your mother wants you to come home. And I thought, well, that's weird. You know, that's really bizarre. She's never requested I come home. And, you know, I just remember him packing up my stuff and, you know, being summoned to go home and getting there. And just, you know, my mother was like, you know, we cannot go outside. It's just not safe out there. And really sort of feeling like, you know, we were under siege.
There were 4 of you in the house at that time, right? Your mother and 2 sisters and you.
Yes. And I had a cousin that lived with us also in a 2-bedroom apartment.
And your older sister, Renee's mentally disabled. Was that hard for you as a kid if you couldn't really play outside, so you were inside, and your mother was away a lot of the time working as a domestic worker? So what was that like for you at home?
Renee, as a teenager and as a youngster, was incredibly violent and incredibly jealous. So it wouldn't take much of anything for her to sort of burst out into a rage and become violent. I can remember being thrown down the steps or, you know, just hit. So our entire lives, in terms of if we went out to grab a bite to eat, or, you know, if we participated in an activity, whatever, it was always centered around Renee and how she was doing that day. So, you
I
know,
can
so,
see that generating a real resentment.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Was that an understatement?
Yes. It's hard, you know, it's hard growing up with someone because you feel so conflicted, you know. I mean, one of the things that my mother said over and over and over again to us is that, you know, it could have been you. You could have been disabled. You're just lucky that you're not. So, you know, be nice to your sister and don't provoke her. And so even the idea of defending, you know, myself against Renee when she would hit me with the, you know, the telephone receiver or whatever was considered a big no-no.
Beverly, you mentioned that you were at Grimsley High School. Now, at the time, that was a mainly white high school, wasn't it?
That's correct.
So you were bused over there?
I was bused K through 12. So I started, you know, when I was in kindergarten, I was going to predominantly white schools.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's funny because, you know, there's sort of a, you know, I hear buzzes of a debate about the idea that desegregation was not such a good idea. But I think for me, it really was to my advantage to do that. You know, I was covered in poverty in Morningside Home, and people who were perhaps because they couldn't do any better that were going to repeat that cycle in that, you know, their kids were going to be in the projects. And I had the opportunity to see through going through these white schools, another way of existing. A lot of middle-class people, upper-middle-class people, were my classmates. And they had values about going to college and wanting more out of life.
Tough for you, though, because you couldn't be the same person in both places, right? You wouldn't come to Grimsley and say, you want to know what I saw, you know, outside my house in Morningside Homes this morning, right?
Exactly. I did a total disclaimer and pretended like I didn't live in the projects. And when a friend would offer me a ride home, I would get out of the car early, you know, before I ever got to the projects and just pretended like, and wait until they left and then walk the rest of the way home.
What was the excuse you'd use? What would you say?
Well, they would know. You know, I just get out in front of a house. You know, just get out of the car. Say, oh, here's my house. See you. Huh. You know, it was really, you know, very bizarre.
Beverly joined the clown club at Grimsley High. She wrote later that it was an escape, that when she was dressing up and covering up, she wasn't black or poor or from the projects, that she could pretend to be a white girl.
I put on white face and I had a blonde wig and I covered my body from head to toe. So no one knew I was black and no one knew I was poor or from the projects.
You'd have been, what, maybe 16, 17 years old at the time?
Yes.
Did you do that covering up, white face, full costume on purpose? Or looking back on it now, are you able to look and think, oh, that must have been what I was doing?
We had certain rules. I mean, there was a clown club at Grimsley High School. And the idea was that you wanted to cover up, you know, most of your body. You know, it was never an option to put on blackface or to be a black clown, in fact. You know, it was all white grease paint. And so, you know, I put on the white grease paint and I made blonde wig out of yarn and it went out.
And you got into this too, right? I mean, at one point, didn't you apply for a job as a professional clown?
I did. I applied when Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus came to the Greensboro Coliseum. I went there for tryouts.
How'd you do?
Well, not good enough, obviously, because I teach now.
What did you have to do? What was the routine that you did?
We weren't dressed, the people who were trying.
You weren't allowed to wear your white face and your wig and your suit. Oh, interesting.
You were not allowed to hide, basically. And that was when I felt like I could be anybody, was when I was in that garb. And the fact that I couldn't do that for this interview, I think, made it maybe not so great at being a clown.
There's a story about a party you went to or a time when you were clowning and some little girl right. outed you? What's that story?
Yes. I wonder where she is today.
She's listening right now.
I used to do when I was an undergraduate at Central. I joined a balloon company and would often go to hospitals and to birthday parties.
So this was like a student job that you had, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. So I went to this party and, you know, all these, you know, 3-4-year-olds were, you know, clamoring all over me and stuff. And there was this cute little blonde girl who had like curly locks. And I remember her sitting on my lap, like me picking her up and putting her on my lap. And she was just talking to me. And the sleeve of my outfit and where my white gloves that were my mother's church gloves that she had given to me separated. And through that peaked my black skin. And I just remember this little girl, like, seeing my black skin. She was on my lap and seeing my black skin and, like, immediately hopping off and saying, "Oh, my God, the clown is black. The clown is black." And it was devastating. I mean, it was like, it was just unbelievable. It's one of those things that really has just stuck with me into my adult life. And I immediately covered my skin, you know. And it was close to one of the last experiences I had as a clown. I just said, why am I doing this? And didn't pursue it after that time.
It was while Beverly McKeever was in college that she tried her hand at painting, and she discovered that she was good at it. She soon learned that what she was best at was painting portraits, her own, her sister, and her mother, and nothing was off limits. I'll talk more with Beverly McKeever in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking this hour with the artist Beverly McKeever. Her paintings are in public and private collections across the country. If you take a look at our website, thestory.org, you'll see some of the portraits that she does, and you can also see a picture of her in her clown getup. As Beverly explains it, her best work is her most personal work. She tells one story about coming to terms with the resentment she felt towards her older sister, Renee. Renee's mentally disabled and always seemed to command most of her mother's attention. Beverly was trying to do a portrait of Renee.
You know, at first I was trying to paint her as someone who was similar to me in that we were both outsiders. So I would start a painting of her and, you know, it'd be a beautiful, big-headed portrait of her. And then all of a sudden I would just, you know, start scratching her face out. You know, like my brush would just like start erasing her image. And, you know, I mean, it would feel good to do it, but I felt incredibly guilty and incredibly sad about doing it. You know, then I would cry and on and on and on. And so after I completed that body of work, a friend of mine said, well, you know, we've been hiding behind your sister for so long. Why don't you paint yourself? And when I started painting myself, the white face clown image seemed to be the most honest image of myself. And that's why I painted that image first.
How did you make the switch from doing self-portraits in whiteface to doing self-portraits in blackface?
I was living in Durham and actually teaching at Duke, and I would go to the dance festival every year that Duke would have. And one of the performances that I saw was this French dance company performing in blackface. And it was at that moment that I realized that I could be a black clown, because I had never seen any black clown images or never really thought that I could actually be a black clown. And so the very next day I went to the costume store and bought an Afro wig and black face paint and painted myself up. as a black clown.
Did you ever clown in blackface, or was it just to do your portrait?
I never clowned in blackface. I just used the image to make paintings. And it's a very liberating process in that, you know, immediately I was like, oh, I can put on hip-hop music and dance, which as the white-faced clown, I never felt like I could be that raw or aggressive.
Yeah.
I always felt like I had to be a proper little clown, whatever that means.
but some of those early blackface paintings are curious to me. There's a series where you have a woman in blackface cutting up and eating a watermelon. I mean, it's a combination of some of the most potent symbols that have to do with that whole minstrel image, that whole Jim Crow notion of blacks.
Right.
And I mean, that to me, when I look at that, it goes so far beyond clowning. I look at it and I think, I got to talk to Beverly about that. What's going on there?
Well, you know, the thing is that through that liberation of figuring out that I could be, you know, a black clown, I started investigating stereotypes that surround black people. And of course, the first one that came to mind was this idea that all black people like watermelon. So I made several paintings of me eating watermelon, cutting watermelon open, thrusting it in the face of the viewer, etc. And part of me is just like saying, what a silly notion that this piece of fruit would be assigned to a group of people based on their color. And so it was me just sort of saying, you know, this is very silly. It was also me trying to feel comfortable with eating watermelon in public. I've always felt like I couldn't do anything in public that was too black because white people were judging me and saying, see, I told you black people like watermelon. So I've always was really timid about doing things like that or eating a lot of fried chicken in public because I didn't want to be part of that stereotype.
Beverly's career as an artist soon took her away from home. She lived in Vermont and Florida, California, New York, and she ended up as a professor at Arizona State.
I would come back to Greensboro for Christmas and clearly remember sitting on the couch and seeing my mother and my sister put on their hat and coat and bundle up. And I said, where are you guys going? They said, we're going to hang out clothes. And I thought, but it's freezing out there and you have a dryer. And they said, no, we like the way it smells when we hang it out on the line. And I just remember thinking, I cannot believe they're out there hanging out clothes. And I took my camera out there and photographed them doing that and made paintings from it because I thought it was like this ritual that they were totally enjoying this act of hanging out clothes. You know, to me, the clothesline has these negative connotations of just being poor. Because, you know, they were right outside of our apartment and we had to hang out clothes because we didn't have a dryer.
Yeah, the really rich neighborhoods aren't even allowed to have clotheslines because they're considered a symbol of poverty, right?
Yeah, and here they are just like completely oblivious to that and like saying, we like the smell.
In a funny way, though, I mean, it's also a fascinating insight into your mother's caring for Renee, because that's something that they could do together, and your mother would have known that, right? The kind of
Absolutely.
Act that they could share.
Yes. I think my mother was incredibly, just intuitively sensitive to things that she could do with Renee that would provide Renee with some, you know, sense of pleasure and pride about having a responsibility, but was also just, you know, a good thing that they could share together.
It must have been around about this time, or perhaps even earlier than this, when your art was selling well and for a good price. And I know that's always a measure of achievement for an artist. But I'm wondering, Beverly, if there was a time when you knew that you were good at what you did.
You know, it's funny that you ask that, because one of my students at Arizona State University, I was out of class when I went to North Carolina for both the opening at Tyndall Gallery and the NCCU Art Museum. And she said to me, so when did you figure out that you were famous? She said. And I said, you know what? I just did this past weekend when I was standing in that museum And I looked around the walls. I mean, this is an institution that I was an undergraduate student. And the idea of ever even showing in there was like an impossible dream. And, you know, I looked around the room and I saw work that I had done 15 years ago that, you know, I just fell in love with all over again. And that there were people around me who loved me and who had followed me and who had been with me 15 years ago and who are still with me today. It was pretty fabulous. I felt loved and really accomplished and famous for the first time.
Beverly's home in North Carolina, her family, her memories continue to inspire her art. When I spoke with Beverly last year, she was still painting her way through feelings about her mother's death.
I was living in New York at the time that my mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I remember going to North Carolina and talking with my brother-in-law, who was, who's a doctor there, and him just saying that she might not live longer than 3 months. And I was thinking, what? You're kidding. That can't be. You know, how come no one caught it sooner? Or, you know, like all the questions that you ask when someone that you love is facing death.
When you came back to Greensboro, you came with your camera and you came with this same determination to document the most personal moments in your life. And so there are photographs and there are paintings of your mother in the hospital with IV tubes. And I don't know how you're able to do that. I don't know if it, as a painter, it's the way that you deal with or face these intense personal moments. But how do you explain that?
Well, you know, I had to make a decision about if I were going to come back and be a grieving daughter or if I were going to be a painter. And I decided that I wanted to be a painter. And I think it is a bit of a coping mechanism because, you know, my mother was and I were so close that the idea of her not being around was just really in many ways unbearable. So I came back and, you know, I asked her if I could photograph her and she was really fine with that. And she was a real trooper. And so I took lots of photographs of her in the bed and even after she died, her mouth was ajar and, you know, it wouldn't shut and, you know, she had lost a lot of weight and, you know, she wasn't looking her best. But I photographed her and have made some pretty swell paintings about that, about losing someone that you love and about this whole dying process. And I even contacted the funeral home because I really wanted to see the process of her being embalmed, but he wouldn't let me do that, unfortunately.
Did he know he was talking to Beverly McKeever?
Well, obviously not. I think that they're concerned about, because he kept saying, well, she'll look better after we work on it. I was like, I don't care. I don't want that. I want her to look like she looks.
What's it like for you when you see them again, though? I mean, once you've created that painting and it's finished, is it still your mother? Is it still as intense as it must have been to create the piece in the first place?
Those particular paintings are still very, very painful. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm not done with it. I'm going to go right back in there this summer when school is over with and when I can, be vulnerable and take 2 or 3 days to recover and paint more of them. You know, the thing that happens with painting for me is that whatever comes up comes out. And the paintings of my mother after she died are still very much inside of me and still need to come out. So I'm going to have to go through that grieving process again. I mean, sometimes I have to completely stop painting because I just, you know, melt down completely because I'm just so sad. And even though my mother's been dead for 3 years, you know, it still feels like it was yesterday in so many ways. So I hate, and, you know, consciously speaking, that I have to address this again. Because, you know, it's difficult to be vulnerable and to be so sad and stuff, but painting calls.
My guest is the artist Beverly McKeever. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Something else changed when Beverly's mother died. It meant that Beverly's mentally disabled sister Renee would now be living with her. It was something that had been mentioned, hinted at, in earlier months and years.
You know, when your mother asks you something like that, and you think your mother's going to live forever anyway, so it's sort of a moot point. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll take care of Renee, no problem.
Yeah.
You know, thinking that my mother would always be around, or that I'd be rich enough to hire somebody to take care of Renee, one or the other.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't even think any more about it until Renee and my mom and I were in Target shopping, and we were looking at lamps. And Renee said, do you think I could have a purple lamp like this when I come and live with you? And I was like, what? What are you talking about? You can't come live with me? You're crazy?
I'm busy. I'm an artist. I have too much to
right.
do.
Exactly. But it was really startling. And I just remember like looking at her and I was like, who told you that? Like, you know, and she said, well, Mom said that that I was going to come live with you. You know, if something happened to her.
I wonder if part of the long process of coming to terms with your mother's death is linked in any way to the fact that you've taken on the responsibility that your mother had.
Yes. Renee is a constant reminder of my mother. Renee loves dates, so she's very date-oriented in that, you know. It was just March 29th that my mother died. It was marked 3-year period that she had died. And Renee was completely broken up and crying and stuff. And it actually made me feel uncomfortable. I mean, I didn't know how to console her or make her feel better or, you know, I didn't know whether to, like, say, get over it. It's been 3 years. What's the problem? You know, you have a good life. You're middle class now. Be happy. You know, it was really quite bizarre. So she's a huge reminder. And she often says, you know, when I cook for her, she says, you know, you make your meatloaf is as good as Mom's.
Or it's not as good as Mom's. That'd hurt more.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, so she is a real big reminder of my mother and keeps my mother alive and in the present with us every day.
Does she still have seizures?
Yes, she does. And that's really, really tough. I mean, that's one of the things that is incredibly alarming to me still. I mean, after 3 years of living with her, you know, she usually has seizures at night, in the middle of the night, and she wakes me up. You know, she's in the bed, she has a seizure, I wake up, and...
You wake up because you hear her, right?
Because I hear her. She usually calls out to me.
Right.
And I run down the hallway into her room, you know, and just sort of stand there and massage her back while she's having a seizure. And then she has to go to the bathroom after the seizure, which is a complete nightmare, in that she's completely dead weight from having the seizure.
She's exhausted.
And completely exhausted and limp. So it's like trying to walk with an alcoholic. And it's really, really tough. And sometimes, you know, she's fallen and she didn't make it to the bathroom. She just wet all over the floor and herself. And it's just so horrible. It's a horrible thing to witness and a horrible thing to feel so helpless because I can't pick her up or... You know, I can't make it better, and I can't get her to the bathroom any faster. So,
you
it's still alarming.
There you are thinking to yourself, you know, would Mom have got her to the bathroom, right?
Mom definitely would have got her to the bathroom, for sure. And, you know, I just usually just, you know, put her in the guest bedroom and say, you know, just take your gown off. Here's another one. Go sleep in the guest bedroom tonight. And then she goes back to sleep instantly, you know? She's like, okay, and I swear it's not even 5 minutes that's that right. pass, and she's snoring, you know?
While you're on your hands and knees in the hallway floor, right?
Exactly, exactly. And then I can't go back to sleep. I'm wide awake, you know, because I feel so inadequate in doing this job that, you know, I sort of beat myself up.
Things have changed for the painter, Beverly McKeever. She and her sister, Renee, had become accustomed to their new arrangement, living together in Arizona, caring for one another. And since I last talked with her a year ago, Beverly's been through another big change. She has moved back home to North Carolina. I'll talk with her about how that's changing her art in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with the artist Beverly McKeever. Her intensely personal portraits of family members have been seen in shows across the country recently. When I first spoke with Beverly, she was living with her mentally disabled older sister, Renee, and she was teaching and painting in Arizona. At that time, she said her sister still hadn't quite adjusted to life away from her first home in Greensboro.
She still calls a radio station in North Carolina every morning to do birthday, you know, birthday wishes to people. You know, it's like this is a 3-hour time difference. So, you know, she's up very early to do that. You know, she knows how to email, and she often says when she does something, like if she works out something on the computer or like she's knitting scarves now, and she often says, I wonder what Mom thinks of me doing this.
That must give you some pride.
Yeah, it does. It does. I love her. Probably in the last 6 months, I've come to love Renee in a very different way than I loved her before. And, you know, like, I mean, I don't have kids, so I can't speak to that, but it is something maternal in that way that I'm really protective of her, and I love her, and I'm concerned about her well-being, which I think the only other person that I've ever felt that way about is my mother.
You're happy with the amount of painting and teaching that you're doing?
Well, you know, I haven't painted in a couple of months, which makes me extremely nervous, because that's a long time for me not to paint. But I've just been so busy. But I have, you know, in every way that I possibly can, tried to just incorporate Renee into my life. I mean, when I go to North Carolina or go to an exhibition, I usually bring Renee with me. And Renee sells her potholders at the opening and, you know, makes a couple hundred bucks. And I sell my paintings. So sometimes I don't sell my paintings. I can totally remember one of the first shows that I took her to, and she had like over 100 potholders that she had made on this little loom, you know.
I know where this is going.
And she, you know, she like sold all the potholders. She had like $300 in her hand, like cash right in her hand. And yeah. I didn't sell one painting. And I'll never forget her coming up to me and saying, holding that money in front of me and saying, Beverly, I'm really sorry that you didn't sell any paintings and that I made all this money off my potholders. And I thought, that is not a statement that comes from someone who is retarded. You know? Just not.
I'm going to let you get away with calling your sister that. I'm not going to call her that.
So she keeps me humble. You know?
When did you start painting yourself without paint on your face? When did you start painting Beverly McKeever's real face?
Well, you know, that's a real new occurrence since Renee has been in my life, since I've been taking care of Renee. And, there, you know, there's sort of a no-nonsense rule in the house is that, you know, Renee is real. And she calls it as she sees it. You know, she's 47, but she has the mindset of a second grade. So she has a real honesty of a kid. And
is she a tough critic of your art?
She's actually pretty nice in that as long as I'm painting her, like if I start painting somebody else and she's like, when are you going to paint me again? You know, it's all about her. Or if I say, oh, I'm so tired, you know, I got to get out there and get some painting done. You know, it's so hard to be an artist. And she'll say, oh, I know, I'm an artist too.
But I interrupted your answer about painting yourself without paint on your face. She makes it real, and that's and that forces you to just confront things you weren't confronting before. Is that a reasonable way of putting it?
Well, I think what happened is that I grew comfortable in my own skin. You know, there was this sort of transition that happened from being white. You know, there was a show that I did back in 1992 called When I Was White, where I had on white face.
Right.
And moving from there to this other sort of liberation, to the black face, and thinking, you know, hey, it's okay to be black, and not really knowing, I was aware, but not really thinking that people would see the work in terms of, oh my God, you're being a stereotype, and you're doing this Al Jolson stuff, and blah, 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 and thinking of it in terms of it being derogatory. Moving from there to just being, you know, who I am and taking off the wigs and showing my dreadlocks and showing my skin, my face, and who I really am. So I think it's, you know, it's been over time where, you know, I'm comfortable in my skin and I don't want to be white and I don't want to be blackface, that it's just great to just be me.
Beverly McKeever has since been through a big change. She's now back, living in North Carolina, where she grew up. How she came to that decision is a story in itself. It began when a friend recommended that she see a Rolfer. Now, that's someone who does work similar to a massage therapist. So Beverly arrived for her appointment, lay down, fully clothed on the table, and began to talk to this woman.
And I had just gotten the honorary doctorate degree
from here,
North Carolina Central.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I just got back from Central, where they gave me an honorary doctorate degree. And she said, oh, congratulations, that's wonderful. And I said, yeah, it was really nice. And I laid on the table, and she came back, and she sat beside the table, and she put one hand in the center of my back and one hand, like, right underneath my buttocks. And she was like, eyes closed, like, I was like, I was looking up at the ceiling thinking, I'm going to kill my friend. What is she doing? What the hell is she doing? And how much am I paying her to do this?
And this goes on for some time?
It seemed like forever, but it's probably just a few minutes. You know, and she said, you have a lot of pain in your body from North Carolina, from your childhood. And I was like, yeah, well, who doesn't? That's what I was thinking. And then she said, you need to move back to North Carolina in order to resolve this pain and unblock what's happening in your body.
At this point, you and Renee had been in Arizona how long?
11 and a half years. I turned to her and I said, I'm not moving back to North Carolina. I said, I hate North Carolina. And she said, well, nothing's really going to work out for you until you move back and resolve this pain. And, you know, she left the room and, I mean, she did a couple of little massages, whatever. She really worked the pain right out of my neck, by the way.
So it wasn't all crystal ball stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a bit of massage involved.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it worked. I mean, it went away. She came back in the room and she said, look, I know you don't want to hear this, but I have to tell you this. She said, it's because it's come to me, she said. You're very stoic and you feel like you can't depend on other people because people have let you down in the past. And she said, you've always felt like you had to do it yourself. That's probably part of the reason that you moved out to Arizona. But there's a lot of people in North Carolina who love you and who want to help take care of you and help take care of your sister. And she said, but you got to go back there for them to do that. And she said, it's time for you to go home, honey. That's what she said to me, just like that. And I was like,
was there a little part of you that was going, oh, my God, is she right? Do I have to go back? Like, was there a little part of you that's coming into this?
Well, you know, deep down inside, I was like, I knew she was right, but I just didn't want to face it. I mean, who wants to come home?
Beverly McKeever talked to a few close friends about what this Rolfer had said, and her friends agreed Beverly should move back to North Carolina. And then all the pieces fell into place. North Carolina Central University offered her a job with the salary she wanted and all the time off she needs to do her art. She found a great house and then easily sold her home in Phoenix. And suddenly, Beverly was home. The problem was, she still wasn't sure she wanted to be home. For one thing, it meant grieving for her mother all over again.
I think in Arizona, I could slightly pretend that she was still alive because I didn't see her on a daily basis. But being here in North Carolina, you know, I'm reminded daily that she's not here. And that has been something that has been a really big challenge for me and for Renee because, you know, I want to pick up the phone and call her and say, guess what? Or, can you come and help me arrange the furniture in my house? And those kind of things I can't do. So I think one of the things that I've done since I've been here was had major closure with my mom's death and finally in a place where I could grieve my mom's death. And I've had to, you know, sort of face the fact that, you know, that my mother is not coming back to get Renee and that Renee is completely, fully, legally mine.
How has Renee settled back in? How's she feeling about being back in North Carolina?
Renee loves North Carolina. And I think everything from the landscape to, you know, she can listen to the radio station. She still calls the radio station, but she doesn't have to get up in the middle of the night.
Make
to
a
do
long
it
distance
because
call.
Because of the time difference. So she's really settled in quite well.
Doesn't matter that it's Durham, not Greensboro. Greensboro. It still feels like home to her.
Yeah. I don't think she would want to live in Greensboro. And the reason that I say that is because I often ask her, we were just in Greensboro over the weekend visiting family, and I ask her if she missed being in Greensboro. And she said, no, I like being with you.
I hope you take that as a compliment.
Whether she intends it or not. She totally adores me. So, I mean, that's priceless. You know, I mean, that's one thing that, you know, her being in my life is such a gift in that regard, is that no one adores me like Renee does. You know, I mean, she'd fight for me. She'd beat somebody up for me.
And is she at peace with the fact that coming back to North Carolina, she's come back to a place where her mother isn't anymore? How's she been with that?
I think she's been very good about that. I mean, I think she's cried less about my mother here than she did when she was in Arizona. So it's in some ways we've had the sort of opposite response to being here. And she has lots of family members around her that, you know, that love her and that, you know, dote on her and stuff like that.
I'm going to pick her up on a Saturday afternoon so you can have a date, or are we still working on that?
We're still working on that. Are you kidding? That's a dream.
Beverly McKeever is still adjusting personally to the change, but she already knows she likes her new job. North Carolina Central is a much smaller school than Arizona State. It's poorer and predominantly black. It's where Beverly went to college.
They all have jobs, and I was that student who ran in late from work because I had to work in order to be in school. I came from, you know, a poor background where an aspiration to go to graduate school would never even cross my mind. So I get it completely, totally. And I think because I get it and because the students know of my meager upbringing and know where I am now, that it gives them a sense of hope and something, you know, because I happen to be a black woman, they can look at me and say, oh, well, maybe this is possible. So that's pretty terrific, you know, that part of being a living example of what they can be.
You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Beverly McKeever is still always exploring her vision of herself in her painting. Since she's been in North Carolina, she started a series of paintings she calls Dear God. It's 9 paintings, all self-portraits, each with stories of her new life in North Carolina written as a prayer over her head.
Dear God, This is my fifth time going to the DMV to try to get a North Carolina's driver's license. Why is it with someone who has 3 degrees cannot pass the test? And why do they make it so hard? And, you know, there's a one called Dear God about Bill Glasgow, who is the guy who, I mean, he's been a huge cheerleader of my work and of me. And one is about talking to him on the phone. I was in my car on my way to work one Thursday afternoon, and he was in a car with a friend on his way to go play tennis. And, you know, he said, "We have won a trip to Hawaii from public radio."
Bill and his wife.
Yeah. And I said, "You're kidding. Like, they're the luckiest people in the world." I was like, "You're going to Hawaii?" And he said, "Yeah, and we have to come down to Chapel Hill to talk to the travel agent to figure out, you know, everything." And he said, "I love to come by and see your house and see you guys."
You hadn't seen him since you'd moved back at this point.
I had not.
Okay.
Right. And he said, "You know, so is that okay?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, be terrific. I'd love to see you and I'd love to show you the house." And he said, "I'm on my way right now to play tennis with a friend." And I said, "Okay, Bill." And he said, "Well, I better let you go." And he said, "I'll call you back and let you know exactly when Judy and I are going to come down." And he said, "I love you, Beverly." And I said, "I love you too, Bill." And he hung up and I hung up and I went on to work. And that same day when he arrived at the tennis court, he had cardiac arrest and died. So that's another Dear God painting, you know, about Bill dying.
How do you fit all that whole story on the top of a painting?
I have to cut it short, you know, and just say that, you know, he died and I didn't get to say goodbye to him, but I did get to tell him that I loved him over the phone, probably less than an hour, you know.
Before his death.
Before he died.
Have you figured out if that sequence of events has some meaning in your life? I mean, is it just a weird set of circumstances, or is it more than that?
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things that is complicated about me being back in North Carolina is that I can't really see in front of me. You know, when I go in my studio to work, the things that I know that are important for me to do is there's something about repetition, which is why there are 9 panels, same image, mm-hmm. different stories. And I'm continuing to do repetitive. I have a series called Coming Home, which sort of, you know, portraits again, self-portraits, but different moods. I recently watched the Greensboro Massacre because someone sent me a link on YouTube where you could actually see footage from this happening, and it just brought back so many memories of sadness for me and injustice and, you know, people who are disposable and all those kind of things, which are wrapped up in the reason that I left North Carolina in the first place.
And a lot of that's not changed.
Yeah. So that just made me really sad and made me think, you know, that's probably part of the reason that I'm here is to, you know, resolve some of that stuff and make peace with it.
We have a picture of one of Beverly McKeever's Dear God paintings on our website, as well as a gallery of her other work. You can see it all at thestory.org. The Story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowwood. Rachel McCarthy and Jen Nathan work as our audio editors. Help for today's show came from Rebecca Blatt. Our engineers are Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar. The Story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of The Story is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.